This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today, the Underground Railroad and the Garrett family. My guest, Mr. Robert Seeley, a member of the distinguished historical Garrett family, who has diligently researched the extensive relationship between his family and the history of the Underground Railroad. A life member of the Pennsylvania State University Alumni Association, a man of many talents, Bob Seeley, I am delighted to have you on University Forum. Welcome.
Great to be here, Gene.
Well, I was so delighted to meet you, and we know that we met at a picnic, and coincidentally, at the home that once had some relationship, and you can tell us what that was, to Thomas Garrett.
Well, we met at Carrie's house, which was Thornfield, and that's where Thomas lived for a period of time in Upper Darby before he moved down to Wilmington.
Well, why is it important to know something about Thomas Garrett? What was that strong relationship that he has in history that we need to know and share?
Well, Thomas Garrett felt as inhumane for slavery, and he wanted to end slavery. He had a vision when he was, and it was about 1813, when one of the servants, paid servants, a member of the family, was taken from our Riverview home, our mansion, and taken to the Philly. And Sarah was upset. That was Thomas's mother. And Thomas got on the horse and went after that carriage, and he brought back a member of the family. And he had a vision from God to end slavery. And it began in 1813.
And when you say brought him back, where was this location where he was, that he was bringing him back to? What part of the area? We're talking about Pennsylvania.
Yes. He found a member of the family in Philadelphia. He was able to trace the carriage because it had a wheel that was broken. So he was able to follow the carriage. And we rejoiced to have her back in the family, the Garretts did.
And this was, you brought her back to the Upper Darby area, was that
right?
Oh,
that's correct. That's correct.
Because it's hard for people to realize today some of that history in these particular geographic areas. That's where Garrett was.
Yes, and it was about the same location as where we met this past summer at Carrie's house.
Well, it was a wonderful meeting because I had heard so much about you, and I know we're going to have a chance to explore a lot that you know about the history here, and I'm going to let you loose to talk about these things. What do you see? Where would you like to start? I heard that you had a recent visit to Wilmington. Is there something there that makes this very important?
Well, January 25th is the anniversary of Thomas's death, and they asked me if I'd come down and speak at the meeting house, and I went down there dressed as Thomas, came in with, "Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on." And there were over 150 children down there in Wilmington Meeting House. And I showed them pictures of the family and pictures of the homes. And I showed them a picture of a dear friend of the family, William Still, who saved the history of the Underground Railroad. And in fact, I visit William's grave each year and put a wreath. He's buried at Eden Cemetery in Collingdale. But it was a special day because it was freedom. And we celebrate that day because of freedom.
And Thomas Garrett and the rest of the Garrett family have been committed to seeing that freedom continues.
Freedom continues through education. And education is very important to the Garrett family. So 1865, when freedom occurred after the Civil War, by the way, in 1866, January of 1866, Thomas received a tea set from the African-American community in Delaware. Getting back to education, education was so important, and education leads to success. The Garretts believe it, as well as the Still family believes it, as a lot of the abolitionists believe. And they opened their homes and schools to children who needed an education.
Now, the Garrett family, when you talk of education, though, what was the religious group that's involved here?
Well, it was the Quakers. But it wasn't just the Quakers on the Underground Railroad. A lot of the Garrett family were Quakers, and a lot attended the Darby Meeting House in Upper Darby. And, of course, Thomas moved to Wilmington, and he was associating with the Wilmington Friends Meeting. But he is also associated with the Longwood Progressive Meeting, which some people consider radicals. They were strong abolitionists, and ended as soon as possible. And they sent a group down to Abraham Lincoln for the Emancipation Proclamation. It was in, I believe, 1862. And the Emancipation Proclamation, I believe, was January of 1863, so they had an influence on it. And not everyone supported that group. They broke away from other meeting houses and formed their own group. In fact, I was there for the 150th reunion of the meeting house. And it was there must have been about 500 people there, I'd say.
How exciting.
Oh, absolutely.
But if you take us back even before these landmark events, there are a lot of things that must have happened in the early days that made it pretty rough and difficult to take a stance as Thomas Garrett and the family took.
Well, it was, because sometimes your neighbors wouldn't agree with you, and some if you had a business, maybe they wouldn't patronize your business. A lot of times you'd be fined. Thomas was tried with John Hunt in 1848 in Newcastle, Delaware. And actually, there were three suits against Thomas. I think the total was approximately $5,400. And Thomas made people believe that he went broke from it, and he was he had to pay the $5,400. Thomas only paid $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't tell anyone else that. Deception is very important on the Underground Railroad, and Thomas was very successful with deception.
Now, wasn't he sort of brought up and sort of vilified because of whatever he did? They felt that he had to pay some sort of penance for it, and that's why he had to pay that kind of money. Some of the stories that I've seen on it suggest that it was this large money that he went broke, as you say, on it.
Yes, but he had family and friends, and family and friends supported one another. So Thomas didn't go broke like some of the people said he did, but he wouldn't tell the people that he did have the money. You know, I'll give you a little story. There was a individual on the Underground Railroad, he went back and to bring other people up, and he was caught. And he was put in jail for it, and he was put up in an auction block to be sold back into slavery. It was with abolitionist gold that brought his freedom. But they didn't know that, and he went north. But it was deception. We supported one another, whichever way we could.
Now, but when Thomas was brought to trial in the John Hunt thing, was this a formal kind of a tribunal, so to speak? I mean, what legal action that was taken? Is that correct?
Legal action was taken in the courthouse against John Hunt and Thomas Garrett, and there were fines levied on both Thomas and John. I think John was about $2,400, $2,500. I think he had to pay his, and with Thomas it was $5,400. So it was formal.
And that's big money in those days.
A lot of money.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of money.
Yeah. But nevertheless, that didn't stop him. I understand he made some pretty strong statements in response to that trial.
Thomas said, if you know a slave in need of food or clothing, send them to me. I am Thomas Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
And he never backed down. He let people know where he stood. And, of course, the law always kept an eye on Thomas's house. I remember, you know, family passes stories down, and of course it's written in our history books. One time there was a young lady in the house, and the house was under watch. And Rachel, Thomas's second wife, took the young lady upstairs and had her wear her clothes. And she came down and took Thomas's arm, as they have the house under surveillance. And Thomas walks her to the carriage. And I could just see Thomas probably smiling and maybe tipping his cap at the people who think they have a watch on the house. And he goes to the carriage and rides away.
And in that way?
And he won again, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did. Took it right out. But how did they hide people if they in that house?
Yes.
And is evident in some of the current structures that still remain.
Yes.
How did they hide people of color during that time?
Well, a lot of times they used the outbuildings on the properties, and they could have been the spring houses. For instance, the Mendenhalls, which were Rachel's family, which were right over the line, about 10 miles over the line from that of Wilmington. And in the spring house, they hid women and children. And in the barn were hid the men and the young men in the barn. But they also had the attic. And we saw in Carrie's house, mm-hmm. the attic, and also the basements were used. And there was a rumor in the basement on Carrie's house, and we talked about this, about the tunnel going from that of Thornfield to Riverview. And I think that's about 100 yards or so away. Maybe it's 200. I don't think there were miners. I don't know if they could dig that far. But these are, sometimes you have rumors and sometimes you have facts. And so these are areas, if we needed to hide slaves, we could do so.
And I've seen that basement at Carrie's house, and it gives you every evidence, every thought that there were ways that they could disguise areas down there in that huge basement area.
And you saw the wall.
Yeah,
the wall
huge.
Goes right down the center with windows on it, and you know that even though that cornerstone says 1800, Gene, you know that part of that was built before 1800.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's fantastic when you look at it now and then think back to the why and the how. And there are human beings we're talking about,
yes,
who are escaping from things that were just unbelievable in terms of inhumanity.
Inhumanity, yes.
You're listening to University Forum with my guest, Bob Seely, and we're talking about the Garrett family and the Underground Railroad. There's so many stories that we've seen and heard, but you know so much of the facts of what took place. And when you talk about the line, we're talking about which states now and what was happening at that time.
Well, you talk about Delaware, where Thomas was with his children, like Eli, who married Frances Sellers. The Sellers were very important. That was Frances was John Sellers and Anna, Elizabeth Poole's daughter. And then right over the line, I'm talking about the line between Delaware and Pennsylvania. And down near Longwood is where the Mendenhalls were, and that was Rachel's line. And they would send them right over the line. Of course, the Cox family was down there, too, very important on the Underground Railroad. And of course, along with Progressive Meeting, slaves were hidden in the meeting house there.
Hmm.
And if you go a little bit further west, you have Westchester. And in Westchester was the Price family, and Thomas Garrett's mother was Sarah Price. Well, that was his first cousin, Benjamin, who lived in Westchester. So a lot of times they were sent to family members and then on to Upper Darby on north and follow the star.
Hmm. Now, when you mentioned Mendenhalls, people think of Mendenhall as a place that exists now, an area and a place, but you're talking about the people who are behind that name.
Yes, that was Isaac and Dinah Hannum Mendenhall, that family.
Yeah. So that you have all of these families now that we just see by names, and now we're finding a little bit more about what happened with them. Now, bring in for me the role of William Still, and differentiate, if you will, because I know you think non-racially, as do I.
Absolutely.
But we're talking about the fact that we were talking at that period of time. William Still was a man of color. He was of African descent.
Yes.
And here we're talking about the Quakers and the group at that time who were primarily Caucasian.
Yes.
Now, how did William Still fit into all of this?
Thomas would write letters to William Still, and he'd say, "Dear friend," and he signed, of course, Thomas Garrett, your friend Thomas, or T.G. And William Still was on the Vigilance Committee in Philadelphia. And a lot of times you would have slaves come through Philadelphia, and he would record the names of the slaves with the families. And he wanted to do this in case someone else came through that was a brother, a sister, a grandfather, a mother, a relationship. And he wanted to get some type of record so in the future people could find each other. It was so important, and also to save the Underground Railroad. Now, there were laws in place. Families supposedly burned a lot of the letters because of the danger involved of being caught. But William Still was a genius, an absolute genius. He hid the letters in a crypt. When I went down to talk to Clem Still in Lawnside, New Jersey, at the 135th reunion, I said, Clem, where did William hide the letters? Bob, he hid them in a crypt in an African-American cemetery. Brilliant man. Absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
So that's how the Underground Railroad history was saved. It was through William Still.
Hmm. I ask that because I know so often people say, well, it was only those who were white who were saving the slaves, but there was a much closer linkage among others and some of the others who were masters on the railroad, as it was called.
There are many African Americans who played a part on the Underground Railroad as engineers. You have Harriet Tubman, who went back many times back into Maryland and actually went after her family to bring them north. About 300 people she brought north. A wonderful woman. She was only about 5 foot tall, and she carried a pistol on her side. And you better not turn south. You better keep on walking north. Or if you didn't, she'd pull her pistol on you. Many, many African Americans joined the cause. A lot of them didn't go up to Canada right away. They stayed in Pennsylvania and New York and joined the forces and helped many, many people. And history is just being written about them. I'm thrilled that people like James McGowan wrote a book on Thomas Garrett, and William Still, of course, wrote the first book. And then you have a book by R.C. Smedley that Chris Densmore down in Swarthmore College rewrote. So the history of the Underground Railroad is just coming out. I remember in history class many years ago, this was never talked about. It's about time it came to light.
And there are many who don't even know, even though we're using the term Underground Railroad, what that meant.
Oh, yes, yes.
Take us back a little bit more on that, definitively.
Well, the Underground Railroad was a railroad on top of the ground. They called it underground because people disappeared, mysteriously disappeared. And it was a network of people who loved each other, who cared about each other. And it doesn't matter what color skin you are. It really didn't matter. Inhumane treatment was the cause. The cause of is freedom to pick and choose wherever you want to go, whenever you want to go. Can you imagine? You know, I'm thinking, if I was a slave down south and I want to go north, I left people behind, family members behind. That was a tough choice to make. People were sold even further south. Families were split up. It's inhumane, Gene, mm-hmm. Inhumane.
Mm-hmm. And this was really what was happening. We're talking about being owned by, without any ability to make decisions for yourself.
That's right. Yeah.
But when the Underground Railroad was moving along, you mentioned a number of places where they stayed, and you have with you some pictures, and you have some maps and that traces people from. Talk a bit about some of these things that you brought around the table that our listeners cannot see, but they can visualize from the way you describe so much of things.
Let me see if I can paint you a picture, Gene.
Paint it.
In Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, there are two creeks. One's Darby Creek and the other's Cobbs Creek. And in between those two creeks were Garrett and Sellers properties. And the Garretts are four marriages between our families. I consider it like a fort. If you look at the Darby Creek, you had Nathan Garrett and Charles Garrett along the creek. And on the other, on Cobbs Creek, that was Darby Creek. On Cobbs Creek, you had the Sellers family. The original Sellers mansion was 1684. And then, so you had Millbank and Millbourne. You had the mills down in Millbourne, John Sellers, and up further, you'd have Abraham Pennock, and the families worked together. And in the interior lines, it's like a fort, would be the properties of Thornfield, where Carrie lives, and Riverview, and that's where Holy Child School is now. And that was our original Garrett house, and that would be around where the athletic field is. And the other house is in Arlington Cemetery in Upper Darby, right across from Upper Darby High School. And that was Isaac Price Garrett's house, Thomas's brother. So actually what you had is Isaac P. was in Arlington Cemetery, and he called it Fernland Farms. And he got that around 1840 after their father, Thomas Garrett, died. Mm-hmm. Their father's name was Thomas. And then here, Edward was at Riverview, and Samuel, the half-brother, his mother was actually Levis, and his son, William, who married a Sellers, they were at Carrie's house.
So you had this whole, you could say like a fort.
It was a fort.
A fort of friendship and welcome that in order to be able to carry out some of these things that you're talking about, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I called it, Upper Darby was a safe haven on the Grand Railroad.
I can't help, as I mentioned to you before we began this program, that Upper Darby has gone through many transitions,
yes.
One of which was just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And more recently now, of course, is an admixture of many people from different nationalities. When you mention those names, for instance, Millbourne, there's a railroad train station down there. That's built Millbourne now, right?
Right where the L, that's the first stop on the L out of 69th Street.
Yeah.
And that's where John Sellers and his wife's name was Elizabeth Poole owned the mills. And it's where Sears was. And it's right along the creek, and they owned the mills down there. And, of course, John was a strong abolitionist, and he was actually grew up with Thomas. They were best friends. And here, their daughter marries Thomas's son, Eli, and they're living down in Wilmington. So a very strong connection between our families, the Sellers and Garretts.
What happened to all of these properties and things? Did they just grow and sort of dissipate and get sold off? What happened?
Well, development occurred, but also so a lot of the properties, a lot of them were farmers or owned mills, and over time they were developed. Nathan's property, which is the first cousin of Thomas's, that's where Drexel Brook Apartments are today.
Mm-hmm.
That was developed. It was called Bloomfield, and it went down Bloomfield Road and over that little bridge. And it used to be a cover bridge years ago, and that was developed. Nathan developed that property, and then down in near Clifton Heights was Charles's property, and that was developed. That's Denison Avenue, where Charles' house still actually stands as an apartment building. So it was developed around. Now, would I have loved to see some of these properties preserved? Absolutely. And Riverview was torn down in 1969 to make room for Holy Child. Carrie has preserved the house, and
absolutely.
You know that as well.
Absolutely.
She's done a tremendous job.
Mm-hmm.
Sellers Hall was built in 1684, and 69th Street sits on the property of St. Alice's Church. And Dr. Nilgun Acure, myself, Tom Smith, Bev Rohr, we all got together. We were trying to save Sellers Hall, which is on the Underground Railroad also.
It is important to save some of these markers of history so people don't forget.
Yes, very important.
Yes, and get a sense of all that has gone in to bring us to where we are today. We're going to continue our conversation because there's still so much more to talk about and have a second go-round on this before we close out this first half of a two-part program. The second, which will be played the following week. What do you see as one of the key and important points as far as preserving the history of which you speak? What's necessary to keep history alive?
Well, it takes a lot of money to keep history alive, and I think that's where one problem lies. We just discovered Isaac Pease's house in Arlington Cemetery, and they're committed to get at least an historical marker, and hopefully it will stand. But we need the support of the local communities and the state of Pennsylvania. We need funds to be raised in order to preserve the history. I think it's worth it. The Underground Railroad changed our American history. Can you imagine what our country would be like without the Underground Railroad?
It's hard to believe that there would be any thought of not allowing people to move to places of safety, even today.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for this part of our program. We're going to continue, as I say, and talk more about not just the Underground Railroad, but about that fabulous family which you are a part, the Garrett family. I wish people could see you as you tend to go to some of these presentations and you're made up as the person that you're talking about as you were on the 25th of
January. I have a ball. The kids are fabulous. I love to perform in front of kids, and they're so interesting, the questions they ask. I think I enjoy it really more than the kids.
Just being there. You relive the era.
Yes.
Do you not?
I think I'm lucky.
How is that?
Because I get to live the era. I get to share my knowledge. I'm not taking the degree with me, Gene. I want to share as much knowledge as possible about my family and the Underground Railroad.
Well, we're going to have that opportunity in the second program that comes up on the Underground Railroad and the family of the Garretts. Thank you so much for being in this first part of our program.
And thank you, Gene.
I'm Gene Moore. Please send your comments and questions on University Forum programs to me by email at jemoore@temple.edu or call my voicemail 215-204-4376. And don't forget to listen in next week to the second half of this program.